This week, many Americans are celebrating Juneteenth, a commemoration of the announcement of the end of slavery in the United States. To honor this important history, Arizona Spotlight is presenting this interview with civil rights activist Bernard Lafayette, which originally aired last February. Dr. Lafayette shares his memories of the earliest days of the civil rights movement when he was a pupil of Martin Luther King, and he describes how he had to put his own nonviolent principles into action on the same night that young Medgar Evers was killed. Laura Markowitz brings us the interview.
Civil rights pioneer Bernard Lafayette is a soft-spoken man with a sprinkling of gray hair. His easygoing manner belies the many years of violence and struggle that he's witnessed. He was raised in the segregated Deep South, and he experienced rage and frustration at institutionalized racism. For a time, he became involved with gangs. Then he got his life back on track and went away to college, where he read Martin Luther King Jr.'s books on nonviolence. The vision of peaceful social change inspired Lafayette to become a founder and leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. The way he saw it, working for civil rights was his patriotic duty as an American. Many people in the South didn't see it that way. Lafayette was jailed 27 times for civil disobedience during the 1960s. More than 40 years later, Lafayette continues to teach and apply the principles of nonviolence, which he learned from his greatest mentor, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Martin Luther King believed firmly that nonviolence was the best way. I actually met him in Nashville when we had our sit-in movement in 1960, and he spoke at one of our mass meetings, and he said, "I came not to bring inspiration, but I came to gain information," because we had read his books and we had listened to Martin Luther King, and so we disciplined ourselves according to the philosophy of nonviolence that he taught. We're the first ones that desegregated our downtown lunch counters. When the Freedom Rides were stopped because of the bombing that took place in Anniston, Alabama, it was those of us in Nashville who took up the ride and said, "Well, we can't allow violence to stop a nonviolent movement." And those of us who were involved in the sit-ins and Freedom Rides formed SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in the spring of 1960. And we decided what we wanted to do was to have a full-time operation, and we needed staff. So some of us decided that we would drop out of school for 2 years and make a two-year commitment to work for civil rights and social change. At 22, I dropped out. Well, when I went to Atlanta, where we had our headquarters, there was an emergency because some of our people who had already started were arrested in Louisiana and charged with conspiracy to overthrow the state of Louisiana.
What had they been doing?
Trying to help black people get registered to vote. And it was only one person who was arrested. Two others we sent from SNCC to visit them and let them know, give moral support, and let them know that we were, working to get them out, because they had $10,000 cash bond. So we didn't have that kind of money as a young student organization, so we decided what we'd do is go north and try to raise the money. I went to Detroit. By this time, two other people had gotten arrested and charged with conspiracy. So instead of $10,000, we had to raise $30,000. So we did that very quickly. When I finally got back to Atlanta to take my assignment, they said, "Well, all the assignments are gone." I said, "But I thought you said I would be a director of one of the voter registration projects." We called it voter education in those days. They said, "Well, you can be an assistant director." I said, "No, I have to be director." So he said, "Well, the only place left, is Selma, Alabama." And they had an X through Selma, Alabama, because two other teams of SNCC workers had gone there and returned with the same response. And that was that you can't accomplish anything in Selma, Alabama, because the black people are too afraid and the white folks are too mean. They said, "Well, if you want to go down and take a look at it and see what you think." I said, "No, I don't want to take a look at it. I'll take it." The rest is history.
Those days back when you were in Selma, the night that Medgar Evers was killed in Mississippi, you were also beaten up by a white supremacist. Were you tempted to fight back? Did you defend yourself?
The FBI from Mobile told me that there had been a conspiracy. This was after the fact, there were supposed to have been three of us killed the same night. Ben Elton Cox in Louisiana, Medgar in Mississippi, and I was supposed to have been hit in Selma. And that same night that Medgar was killed, I returned from a mass meeting, and there were two young white fellows, one under the wheel and one under the hood of a car. They approached me, one of them did, and asked for a push. So I said, sure. It was late at night, so I know what it's like when your car breaks down. So I didn't even hesitate. In fact, they were white, it didn't bother me. So when I got out and bent over, that's when they clobbered me. Mm-hmm. They caught me on the head. So I thought that was it. But on a personal, physical level here, when I'm being attacked, what you try to do is search for the humanity in your attacker. So when I was hit the first time, I went down and I rolled on the ground, got up again, and looked at my attacker in the face. And this fellow jumped up and hit me again. I went down. And then the third time. By the time I got up the third time, blood was all over my shirt. And then I saw that what he was hitting me with was the butt of a gun. Then he did point the gun at me. I was looking, searching for his eyes, because we were trained that if you can search for the conscience of the person, maybe you can see the humanity there, and maybe they can see the humanity in you. My neighbor came across the banister, and he had a shotgun. I turned around and faced him and told him, don't shoot.
Why did you say don't shoot?
So I said, he would kill somebody, and it wasn't necessary.
Even though another man was pointing a gun at you.
I tried to help save him. And that's what nonviolence teaches. Try and make an attempt to save even those who are attempting to kill you.
Did you ever have contact with your attacker after that?
No, they knew who he was, but no.
Where was the second guy?
He was in the car, and there was nothing wrong with that car. They took off so fast, I didn't know they had gone.
On the morning of the day that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, Bernard Lafayette met with King in his Memphis motel room. They strategized about the opening of the office for the Poor People's Campaign. There was a press conference scheduled for later that day in Washington, D.C., but King told Lafayette that he would have to handle it on his own because King had decided to stay in Memphis to support the striking sanitation workers.
The last thing he told me that morning in Memphis, in his hotel room, in fact, I still have my key. He was in 306, I was in 206. But his last words to me is, Bernard, the next movement we're going to have is to internationalize and institutionalize nonviolence. So I said, okay. 5 hours later, I learned that he was assassinated. I had landed in Washington, D.C. I never had time to mourn his death because there was so much work that needed to be done. The first thing we had to do was have a funeral. So we had to organize. Then we had to complete the demonstration for the sanitation workers in Memphis. And then we had to go and do the Poor People's Campaign. Then I had to figure out what he wanted me to do about internationalizing the nonviolence and institutionalizing.
Did you ever have a moment of cynicism or doubt when Dr. King was killed that this great role model and inspiration for nonviolence would end in such a violent way?
I do have those feelings even now, that it was such a tragedy. But when we have those dramatic losses, it means that we have to work more vigorously to help develop more leadership. And that's what I'm devoted to and committed to. We talk about the past, and it's important for us to never forget the past because those are important lessons. But those lessons are for us to be able to apply to the present problems and more specifically to the future. And that's why we must get young people involved. We were successful in the movement in the 60s by recognizing that we had to change our behavior. It's not what people do to you, what they say to you. You have no control over that. But you do have control, and you have the power to respond. And one of the things that we teach in nonviolence is that you have the power and you must make the change. But your goal must be to help other people have the power to change their attitudes and be able to accept others. There's a reason why, and what we do, we see are the symptoms of a deeper problem.
How can people practice Dr. King's ideals of nonviolence in their daily lives?
Very happy you asked that question. because some people only think about massive social change, that kind of thing. But when people understand the kind of nonviolence that we're talking about, it applies to the people around you. Some people are more violent towards the people in their own family and their fellow workers. So what we're saying is the nonviolence we're talking about is not just somewhere else. How do we relate on a personal level? First of all, we have to train people in school. They don't learn how to manage conflict in their lives. All the other things they've learned will not matter.
For Arizona Spotlight, this is Laura Markowitz.